From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. Lawmakers on Capitol Hill are still trying to find a bipartisan solution to the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, or DACA. That's the Obama-era program that protects young undocumented immigrants from deportation. But there's considerable disagreement over whether Congress should take up a so-called clean DACA bill, as Democrats want, or include funding for a border wall, as President Trump insisted yesterday. On CNN this morning, House Minority Whip Steny Hoyer was asked if Democrats could compromise over a border wall.
What I understand is the president is concerned about security at the border. We're concerned about the security of the border. I think there's an overwhelming opinion that we need to maintain security at the border. How you get there will have to be discussed. The president talks about a wall. We talk about other items that we think will be much more effective.
Well, there's only one bipartisan proposal in the works right now. It's sponsored by California Democrat Pete Aguilar and Texas Republican Will Hurd. Congressman Hurd joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
So first of all, can you describe your proposal here a little bit? Because I've seen it described as being as narrow as possible. What does that mean?
This plan is a permanent legislative solution for children who came here of no fault of their own. And it also focuses on achieving operational control of the border using technology, physical barriers as deemed necessary. And we also address the issue of immigration system backlog that, you know, has been, you know, driving some of the root causes of unlawful immigration. So ultimately, it's a DACA fix plus smart border security.
Okay. Now, your DACA fix provides recipients a pathway to a green card, qualified recipients, I should say, a pathway to a green card and perhaps even eventual citizenship, not to their parents or families. I'm just curious, though, it seems to me that while there's this consensus in Congress right now and even with the president that something needs to be done to fix this, it's also a very fragile moment. I mean, are you concerned that offering the green card and pathway to citizenship might drive away some Republicans from wanting to sign on to the bill?
No, I don't think it is. But I think the word fragile is probably accurate to describe where these negotiations are. The first thing is this is not a special pathway to citizenship. And these actually have some very strict requirements in order to transition from conditional status to lawful permanent resident status. So 2 years of school beyond secondary school, or completed a full term of enlistment in the U.S. military, or have been gainfully employed for 80% of your time that you're here to potentially apply for citizenship.
Mm-hmm. You know, I had asked you about whether or not you're concerned about losing Republicans. Are you and Representative Aguilar also potentially concerned about losing some Democrats? Because your bill would allow for the creation of a smart wall, for example, along the U.S. border. And there are some Democrats who don't want any funding for any kind of wall on the border.
Sure. We've accepted the fact that we're not going to get 435 yes votes on this piece of legislation. All we need is 218. Here in Washington, D.C., the way folks negotiate, it's through subtraction, not addition. You know, we put all these, everything in the kitchen sink out there, and then try to, you know, take things away. Let's start with the basics and add things so that we can get everybody to a yes. You know, one of the things I learned during my time in the CIA as an undercover officer, it's always better to under-promise and over-deliver than over-promise and under-deliver.
We talked with Congressman Goodlatte, who, as you know, mm-hmm. Has another proposal. He's co-sponsoring another proposal, hiring 10,000 new border and customs officers, $30 billion for a wall, the E-Verify program. Are those ideas, they're things that members of your party have wanted? Would you be willing to consider them in your bill?
So I'm willing to consider a lot of things, but here the reality is you have to have nine Democrats. If you get all Republicans, you have to have nine Democrats in the Senate in order to get anything done. So, you know, this is about the art of the possible. There's 2,000 positions within Border Patrol that are unfilled, and they're having a hard time to hit that goal. So and a lot of folks talk about the diversity visa lottery system as well. There's actually bipartisan support on how to change that. And so, again, what are those areas? What are those issues that can get more yeses? And let's talk through them, and let's do that in a bipartisan way. And if it needs to be added, we can add it.
Well, Texas Republican Congressman Will Hurd, it's been a real pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, this winter has been frigid in parts. That's meant ice. Have you fallen? I went down hard in an indoor parking garage. I was just thinking, why do they paint the walkways? That makes them slippery. When my advancing foot began walking without me on black ice, and there I was in full gymnastic split. I do yoga, but I'm no gymnast. You could hear the hamstring pop throughout the garage. There is talk this winter about better ways to fall. Kevin Inouye is a stuntman and assistant professor of acting, movement, and stage combat at the University of Wyoming. Kevin, the Dutch now give hundreds of classes in how to fall like stunt people. So how do you teach students to fall?
I try to teach them not a fall, but what we want is a controlled descent. So don't think about trying to stop yourself when you reach out. Think about trying to slow yourself down.
But also, it sounds like tip yourself over. Try to fall on the fleshier, whatever's the fleshier, meatier part of your body, not a hip or a knee or a bone.
Yes. If we stop right away, whether that's by hitting a hip bone or a wrist or an elbow, it's going to be hard on the whole body right there.
So maybe even tuck your arms in. Don't fight the fall. Roll with it like a paratrooper.
Yeah, there's a couple things that paratroopers do that are specific to their type of fall. But for me, I actually like to extend my arms a little bit, in part because that makes the elbow go away. When you straighten a limb, the knee or the elbow no longer sticks out. And to me, that's where a lot of people get the most routine injuries.
But overall, you say aim for the meat, not for the bone.
Yes.
Aim for something soft. That's kind of if you roll over. What if you do that kind of slip where your feet go out from under you and you fall on your back and your head?
When I'm doing a backfall, I try to aim for that area of basically my shoulders, not the top, but the back, where you'd want to wear a backpack. And the other important part there is to breathe out as you hit. If you are hitting your torso, don't hold your breath. Sometimes our instinct is to kind of suck air in and hold our breath when we're surprised by something or scared. And that can help contribute to you getting the wind knocked out of you. Whereas if you're breathing out naturally, you're a little bit more relaxed and dissipate the force.
And try to tuck your chin to your chest.
Yeah, I don't want to tense it up. I think tense necks get injured more as well. But if you think about having a point of focus, if you are looking forward while you fall back, you're generally not going to hit your head.
So being rigid is your enemy, bending your arms, you know, making your elbows vulnerable, not a great idea. What about falling forward? You know, you trip over something. It's a curb you didn't
sure.
see because it's covered in snow. Then you're face planting.
That tends to be where we get in trouble by reaching out and trying to stop ourselves. So one thing you can do is try to maintain balance as much as possible. And part of that is reaching in the opposite direction of your fall. So if we throw everything forward when we start to fall forward, we're actually accelerating into that. So if I can keep one foot, you know, if one foot is caught on something or is slipping back, I want to keep that foot back as far as possible because that also helps me counterbalance a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then I'm going to try and reach up, usually above my head, to get a little bit of that same kind of slap, break, fall that you'd have in judo or aikido or something like that.
Well, by the way, we mentioned the Dutch. The courses there are called Vallen Verleden, I think, Tijd. I'm of Dutch descent. I think I just murdered that. But it roughly translates as falling is in the past. And they've got hundreds of courses across the country. It's taught by, you know, professionals, physical therapists. It's covered in part by insurance. You're teaching falls to would-be actors. Do you think that we should be practicing falling?
I think it would be a great thing to have as a part of physical education in schools. I mean, these are useful life skills, perhaps more than climbing rope or playing basketball.
Or you could grow up to be a stuntman, as Kevin did. So my fall, one foot was off the ice, one foot was on, and there I was in a split. What could I have done? How could I have stopped that? It was so fast. I don't think I could have rolled.
I think the best thing for this is a little preventative medicine. And so some of this is also in thinking about the ways in which we walk. Keeping a low center of gravity, stepping with a full flat foot instead of with the heel first, not leaning before the foot is there to catch you, taking slightly smaller steps perhaps.
Walk like a penguin.
Keeping the knees bent.
They say. But it was a parking garage.
Yes, yes. And we don't always know when it's coming.
By the way, we understand when your wife was pregnant, she took a fall, but some of these techniques you've described helped her?
Yeah, actually, we one of the things that we did when we were first getting to know each other is we were in the same martial arts class, Bujinkan Nimbo Taijutsu class. And so we had learned shoulder rolls in that class, which I do actually use in stunt work and stage combat fairly regularly as well. And so, yes, she tripped over something and started to fall forward, and she said that was the best forward roll she'd ever done in her life.
Took a roll, like a somersault.
It's a little different from a somersault because rather than trying to look pretty and be symmetrical, which takes you then towards your head and over your spine, a martial arts shoulder roll, we're going diagonally across the back. So a little different from a somersault.
Next time, I will do that.
There's a, let's see, Victorian mixed martial art from England called Bartitsu. One of their breakfalls involves actually doing the splits, but presumably they stretch in advance or something. I don't know.
Kevin Inoue, stuntman, also an assistant professor of acting, movement, and stage combat at the University of Wyoming. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And I personally do not recommend a split to break a fall, not being a martial artist. But Kevin also says, try the shoulder roll before you're on ice because muscle memory is important.
This is the music of world-renowned cellist Yo-Yo Ma, MacArthur Genius winner mandolin player Chris Thiele, and MacArthur Genius winner bassist Edgar Meyer. So what do you get when you combine that much musical talent? Well, you get the dazzling Bach Trios, which the group recorded last year. In April 2017, we were privileged to have the trio come into our studios for a performance and a little conversation. Yo-Yo Ma, welcome.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be in one room with two geniuses.
And those other two geniuses are Edgar Meyer. Welcome to you.
Pleasure to be here.
And Chris Thiele, it's great to have you as well.
It's great to be here, Magna. It could have been you that was one of the two.
I think it's safe to assume that I would not include myself amongst the list.
Well, that's what makes you a genius.
I'm referring, of course, to their MacArthur Genius
Awards. My goodness.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why, you know, I just like to kind of bask in reflected glory. And I can hear it every time I hear them play. The quality and content of what they do is so gorgeous.
Well, and hearing the three of you come together is magnificent as well. But, I mean, okay, since we're on this thread of genius, let's talk about Bach a little.
Yes, there we go.
Now you're talking.
In the liner notes for your album, Timo Andres writes that put any random combination of musicians in a room together, no matter what their instruments, histories, or personalities, it's more than likely they'll find common ground playing Bach. Why is that?
I think because some people write specifically for an instrument. But I think his concept of music, since he was an organist, and an organ actually represents so many instruments, I think his language is more architectural than indoor painterly kind of style. So you mix mandolin, cello, and bass, I think a combination that's never really occurred before. Remarkably, it sounds fabulous.
It is surprising. I mean, even in our world of more bluegrass-related things, it's one of the first places people go. Everybody seems to be attracted to it.
Just about any serious musician I've ever had a conversation with, arguments about who the greatest musician ever was start really boring because it's just Bach. You're all set to disagree with someone and no one says anything else.
Yeah.
But then, you know, you get to number two and then the debate starts.
You just said a moment ago that this unexpected combination of cello, bass, and mandolin, and yet the three of you make it work so spectacularly. I mean, how do you make it work?
It is so fantastic to make music with people who have incredibly strong identities, but the content of what they do transcends ego placement. I feel the flexibility of their minds.
At this point, there's actually not that much thought. It's just your speaking voice. It's just like we're three people who like to talk to each other regardless of, like, maybe having sort of a perfectly, you know, low sonorous voice and, you know, someone with, like, a silvery voice. It has to do with what we're going to say. For the three of us, your speaking voice sounds like a cello. Edgar sounds like a bass, mine sounds like a mandolin. That's just what we have to work with, and we like speaking with one another.
Well, speaking of talking to each other, you've all got your instruments here, and I would love it if you could play something from the new album. Again, it's called Bach Trios.
Ready for us? Here we go.
Was so, so beautiful. I was also intrigued by watching how you were actually engaging with each other because you were talking about hearing each other's voices.
That piece is particularly good in that way because that piece really is three voices, three totally separate voices, each with something to say, but that, you know, combine for a harmonious whole.
You know, a melody like that, an ostensibly simple melody that can contain so much is, you know, this is one of the things that I've learned so much about, you know, having grown up playing mandolin, which is, you know, you tend to fill up the space mm-hmm. because, you know, your instrument doesn't really fill it up naturally. So you just kind of play more and more and more notes. Interacting with these two gentlemen has given me a newfound appreciation for space and for the beauty contained in a simple, you know, I think about Yo-Yo's first entrance. Da, 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 da. And, I mean, every time it happens, we've played this piece a lot of times now, every time it happens, I get chills.
It's so funny because this time, I was so locked in to what you were doing, Chris, and I was just mesmerized by the sheer delicacy of phrasing, how intimate it was. And so in that sense, it's a real privilege to be part of that.
I was feeling quite emotional listening to you guys play, to be perfectly honest, because you used the word delicacy and tenderness. I felt a tenderness. And to be quite honest, I feel like the world could use more tender silences or tender spaces.
Very well put.
One thing I was just thinking about, one of the purposes of learning how to play an instrument really well is so that you can go beyond the instrument. Sure, you're playing the bass, you're playing the mandolin, you play the cello, but you actually want to transcend that instrument so that you don't hear instrument, but rather you're hearing music. Here we are supposedly good at doing those instruments, but we're actually also then playing music that tries to transcend itself. And that's some of the feelings we get from playing some of those pieces, especially like, which is the one that I love so much.
Ich ruf zu dir.
Yeah.
Right?
You're in a space that is so wondrous and so amazing. This man was able to create the code that brings us all together into that space of wonder. I'm just devastated every time I hear it.
Yo-Yo Ma, Edgar Meyer, and Chris Thiele. The new album is Bach Trios. Thank you so very much for coming in, for playing, for transporting us. It's been an absolute pleasure to speak with all of you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I'm Robin Young, co-host with Jeremy Hobson of Here and Now from NPR and WBUR. We cover the day's most essential news with analysis and context so you know the why and the what's next. Plus authors, artists, people making a difference. It's a fast-paced snapshot of the world every day. Listen to Here and Now on NPR One or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Things are starting to get serious in the NFL playoffs. After this weekend, it's going to be down to four teams who will still have hopes for a Super Bowl appearance. On Saturday, the Atlanta Falcons play the Philadelphia Eagles, and the Tennessee Titans take on the New England Patriots. Sunday's games pit the Jacksonville Jaguars and the Pittsburgh Steelers, and the New Orleans Saints versus the Minnesota Vikings. So, wow, lots of great teams. Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst, and he hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Hello, Mike.
Hello, and I am serious. I am as serious as the NFL. I do take exception with your assertion that there are lots of great teams, but we will get into that.
Oh, okay. Well, actually, let's start there. Who wouldn't make a list of great teams in all those teams?
Oh, well, I don't think the Tennessee Titans are a very good team, and that's why they're a 2-touchdown underdog to New England. Fortunately, the rule is that there are 6 playoff spots, and someone's got to make it. So there's Tennessee, and they did beat Kansas City in a thrilling comeback aided by some coaching mistakes from former Philadelphia Eagles, current KC coach Andy Reid. So there we have it. I expect the Patriots to just trounce the Titans.
Okay. Well, that's that. Let's move on to the Falcons and the Eagles. Speaking of the Patriots, right, folks will remember when the Falcons blew that huge lead they had over the Patriots in the last Super Bowl. So a chance for redemption here?
Again, I'm going to question if these are two very good teams. So in Philadelphia, which is hosting the game, they are the NFC number one seed. We talked about the Patriots. They're the AFC number one seed. And Philadelphia looked like the best team in football, quarterbacked by Carson Wentz, who was on his way to winning MVP. Then he got hurt. He was replaced by Nick Foles. Nick Foles' first game as quarterback, threw 4 touchdowns against the Giants, seemed good. And then he looked awful. He was terrible against Oakland Raiders. And then he was pretty bad in... limited action against Dallas. Now, maybe people are making too much of this, and I have started reading some statistical analysis that says Philadelphia's defense is still really good. They still have the home field advantage. People are going a little too crazy about the drop-off from the excellent Carson Wentz to Nick Foles. And yet, Atlanta, the road team, a team with three fewer wins, is the favorite in this game. Atlanta was great on offense last year. They have an okay offense this year. Their defense seems to be gelling. But remember, Philadelphia does have the best defense in the league, and it's very hard to go into Philadelphia and face down all those screaming fans.
Gotcha. So what about Sunday's games? Let's touch quickly on the Steelers and the Jaguars.
The Jaguars were a team that I thought during the year, well, they have such a good defense, they could cause problems for the opposition. They haven't looked good recently. They gave up a ton of points to a pretty bad 49ers team, although the 49ers have this quarterback named Jimmy Garoppolo, who you in New England might be familiar with.
Yeah.
And they played the Bills. There was one touchdown scored in that game last week. It was a 10-3 game. They don't look like they have enough firepower on offense. The Steelers, always under Ben Roethlisberger, under center, can throw the ball around. Le'Veon Bell can run the ball. You know, unless Jacksonville keeps Pittsburgh to under 17 points, I don't see how Jacksonville's going to beat Pittsburgh.
Wow. Okay, so we've got about 20 seconds here. Saints Vikings?
This should be the best game of the weekend. Oh. And if the Vikings win and keep winning, the Super Bowl's in Minnesota. Wouldn't that be cool? But the Saints have a really balanced offense. This is the best matchup of the weekend, I would say.
Also, we saved the best for last. That's terrific. Here in Now sports analyst Mike Pesca. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's been a busy week in the world of media. Steve Bannon leaves the right-wing Breitbart, as do investors. President Trump says he wants tougher libel laws after a disparaging book is published about him. NPR's media correspondent David Folkenflik is here to take a look. Hi, David.
Hi, it's been bananas of a week.
It has, hasn't it? But there's also the news that you broke, and we want to start there. That is that James Rosen, one of Fox's top D.C. reporters and a legendary reporter in his own right, left the network quietly after repeat harassment claims that the network seemed to know about for a while. No on-air announcement. First of all, you spoke to many of his former colleagues. What more can you tell us?
Well, I want to be clear. In one of the three cases of an explicit sexual harassment alleged by the eight colleagues that I talked to, one of those there was a complaint made. In two others, they weren't, in part because at least in the first case, I'm told that the person, the woman who experienced it, thought that it was sadly almost par for the course, and this was the culture. What I would say is that Fox, you know, corporately was not informed about these things. But you're talking about three incidents. In one case, back in the winter of 2001-2002, Rosen in a cab back from a meal groped an equal, a peer of another reporter who was female. He grabbed her breast. In a second case, there's less details known, but a producer working for the network covering the State Department complained of harassment. In order to get around any public kind of complaint, worked out a deal to extend her visa so she could continue to work in this country. She was a foreign national at the time.
Well, I just want to jump in there. I just want to jump in there to say before you go to the third one, this was a deal with Fox, and that seems particularly odd because you could say that the Fox News Network, at least, is very much against that kind of deal for immigrants. But in it looks like in exchange for her not making her complaint public, they extended her stay in the U.S.
You might see that as an ideological thing. She's from Britain, so you could argue that they have less problem with people here being here from the UK. But it is utterly consistent with the network's pattern from its founding CEO and chairman of settling one thing after another, paying things out, or arranging things to take care of prominent male figures at the network to insulate them from allegations, including and especially that founding CEO and chairman himself, Roger Ailes. The third incident involving James Rosen was very recent. It was late last spring. It involved a junior female reporter, not nearly as experienced as Rosen. He tried to kiss her in an elevator on the way back from a meal, and when she rebuffed him, he forcibly tried to kiss her a second time. And these were instances where people described and said, you know, James was a particularly aggressive in flirting, but at other times things were outright harassment. Yeah.
Look, almost every network has been touched by these sexual harassment claims, including NPR. But Fox, you could say, started the wave and has struggled to get out from under the shadow of its former chief executive, the late Roger Ailes, accused by more than two dozen women, or Bill O'Reilly for that matter. And what seems to be problematic here is that Fox chair Rupert Murdoch, in mid-December, said this to Sky News.
There was a problem with our chief executive, over the years, but isolated instance. As soon as we investigated, he was out of the place in hours. Well, 3 or 4 days. And there's been nothing else since then.
It was actually that Ailes was out in 13 days, but that there's been nothing else since then. How does that square with what we know about when Rosen left?
Virtually nothing out of Murdoch's mouth was true. I want to be very clear. I don't know if he convinced himself it was true or he knew that he was saying something that was false. But nothing that came out of his mouth in that segment is right. Ailes was, Fox News paid off $3 million to settle a case where a woman alleged that he had coerced sex from her for more than a decade in a very troubling case that was alleged back in 2011. Bill O'Reilly paid off many millions of dollars, high eight figures, high seven figures, I should say. In order to settle the claims of a producer, Andrea Macris, who had sued him in court, and that was over a decade ago. O'Reilly has repeatedly paid off. Most recently, we learned last year of a case in which he agreed to pay $32 million to a former Fox contributor to settle her claim that she was going to file a lawsuit if he didn't settle it, alleging a non-consensual sex. Now, that sounds a lot like rape to a lot of people. We don't know more about the details than that. But an executive, Francisco Cortez, was fired after allegations that he had tried to force a woman to perform oral sex on him. I mean, there's just very troubling stuff. And let's remember, these acts were perpetrated against people working for Fox News. You know, this is a culture that Fox executives privately say right now, look, we're working hard to reverse a somewhat sadistic culture, a controlling culture, a dysfunctional culture that was built up for two decades by Roger Ailes. We're trying to reverse it now. It's going to take time. They would argue that James Rosen's ouster, even if quietly done at the end of the year toward Christmas, is example of proof that they're working to do that. People there say, you know, what took them so long?
Yeah. I want to ask you about Steve Bannon, of course, stepping down as executive chair of Breitbart News because of all the comments that he made in the Fire and Fury book and the Fire and Fury that came at him from the White House and President Trump, but also because investors just were fleeing Breitbart. What does he do now?
You know, what he's going to do is look for another billionaire patron. The Mercer family had been major backers of the Breitbart in its iteration under Bannon, Steve Bannon, after the death of its founder, Andrew Breitbart. Bannon took it more nationalistic. He made it even more incendiary and more conservative than it already was. And he was, in returning from the White House, he'd clearly gotten a political taste in his mouth of wanting to be a kingmaker in politics. You know, he dabbled in that Alabama Senate race and screwed it up for the Republicans, ensuring Roy Moore would be the candidate, and he went down in flames to the Democrat there, a surprise victory for the Democrats. The Mercers have pulled away from him. It seemed to damage their brand in finance. Robert Mercer basically resigning major role at this huge fund that he helped to lead. His daughter denouncing Bannon, although she is one of the controlling owners of Breitbart. He's going to have to find a new patron. Otherwise, I think he's very much alone in the wilderness right now. I think that, you know, you're seeing Bannon's fever dreams of being able to create a new, much more nationalist Republican Party and to prop up that wing against the Mitch McConnells of the world, the establishment Republicans. But I'm having trouble seeing it.
And what about Breitbart? It had become, you know, a home to white supremacists, as you said, nationalists. It also was, a conservative voice. What happened to Breitbart?
I mean, Breitbart, under Bannon, Breitbart flirted with racism and not just flirtation at times, misogyny, homophobia, anti-immigrant, real bashing there, really even more problematic and incendiary than it had been before. And what Breitbart as an institution on the Mercers has done is sided with Trump against Bannon in the wake of this just flagrant split in the Michael Wolff's book. But it's hard to know where they go right now. I mean, they can be adamantly pro-Trump, but they seem to be weak without their propelling engine, that Bannon, that role that Bannon has served for them. In the last week, they seemed immobilized in covering the Michael Wolff's book and the fallout of the Bannon-Trump split. They now have another path, but they're not trashing Bannon. It's not clear to me whether they are going to capture the pro-Trump voice in the way that they have for the past, call it, 2 years, or whether they may be supplanted by other new fighters. We weren't talking about Breitbart this centrally, 3-4 years years ago in the political discourse, not quite as much. We may not be again in the years to come.
It's so interesting. President Trump maybe was vaulted to power by Breitbart, and now he takes it down. I got to ask you real quick. The Washington Post, celebrating its second consecutive year as a profitable company, hiring more people, expanding office space, record subscription numbers. What are they doing right? They have a good movie about them, but what are they doing right?
Well, Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep aside, I think it's always a good business strategy to be owned by one of the richest people ever to walk the earth. Jeff Bezos picked them up and gave them incredible lead time, headspace, and funds to figure out what to do. That said, they've done two things. They've really, bet a lot of money on the idea of using the analytics, which fueled so much of Jeff Bezos's fortunes at Amazon, and applying it to digital usage. They put a paywall in place. And what they've really done is invest a lot of money in a lot of quality as well as a lot of content. Yes, they do a lot of duplicative posts on interesting things, but they have hired a lot of smart, intense, tough, good journalists. And at a time when accountability journalism has never been more important, they're providing it. I think the quality of what they've done has meant that people value them and that they're willing to pay for it digitally as well as in print. And that is helping to sustain them as well.
David, we're going to have you come back to talk about President Trump's calls for tougher libel laws. But just in the seconds we have, do you think that'll happen?
I don't. I think this is a rhetorical device for the president. Yeah. It's not really a federal issue. It's one he likes to do, but it does encourage others here and abroad to make attacks on the press.
David Folkenflik, NPR's media correspondent. David, thank you.
You bet.
Two reporters for Reuters could face 14 years in prison after authorities in Myanmar formally charged them yesterday with violating the country's Official Secrets Act. Hwa Loan and Jia Sa-u were arrested last month after authorities say they obtained documents illegally from officials in Rakhine State, where the Myanmar military has carried out what the U.S. and the U.N. describe as ethnic cleansing. More than 600,000 Rohingyas have fled the violence for neighboring Bangladesh. The Rohingyas are Muslim. 90% of Myanmar's population is Buddhist. The BBC's Jonathan Head is following this story from Bangkok. Jonathan, what were those papers that these reporters allegedly got from police?
Well, we don't know. And in fact, they didn't get much of a look at them before they were arrested. The whole setup looks like something like they were entrapped. These two reporters have been among Reuters' frontline team, getting some of the most detailed and groundbreaking news out of Rakhine State. And it's Rakhine State is mostly off limits to journalists, so it's very difficult to get information. And they were contacted by people. These police officers, they've got, of course, contacts in the security forces, like all the journalists, invited to go for a late dinner on the outskirts of Yangon. And when they were arrived, these two police officers handed over the documents. And from what we understand, from what they've told their families, they were almost immediately surrounded by other police who then arrested them. So we don't know what's in them. Interestingly, many people think they were investigating one particular mass killing in a village, and of course there were a lot of them in Rakhine during the military's operation. Where the military itself now has come out and acknowledged for the first time that its forces did unlawfully kill Rohingyas. It's not admitted that at all up to now. We think there's a link between this admission the military has just made in the last 12 hours and what the Reuters guys were reporting. But of course, Reuters itself is keeping very quiet about what they have because their main priority now is to try to get these guys out.
Is this that brutal attack on a village? We know there was a documentary made of it. We spoke of it here on the program where cell phone video showed that, the massacre of children and the village thought that they were safe. Is this that incident?
It's not that one, but it's around the same time. There were a number of incidents. Some of them were on a horrific scale, mostly where there had been attacks, previous attacks by Rohingya militants. And that seemed to make the violence a great deal worse. The one you're thinking of is in a village called Tulatoli. This is a village called Indin. It was very well covered by Amnesty International through interviews they'd done with refugees. You can see very clearly from the satellite images afterwards how all the Rohingya houses have been burnt. The non-Rohingya ones have been left intact. And it seems from what they heard from the refugees, a number of people were extrajudicially killed there. The military now acknowledges that this mass grave contains Rohingyas, and it's telling us that soldiers killed these 10 Rohingyas. Mm-hmm. They thought they were suspected militants because they were too busy to take them anywhere else. We think that's probably linked to what Reuters was investigating, but also there's a very hostile climate towards the media in Myanmar right now, particularly over the Rakhine issue. These two journalists, they're very courageous, very tenacious, have done some of the most damning reporting, and many people feel in a way they're being made an example of. They're being given this very harsh charge to deter other journalists from digging too deeply.
Well, Secretary of State Tillerson, former President Bill Clinton have called on the Myanmar government to release them. Hundreds of journalists are, you know, stood outside the courthouse dressed in black in protest. Is it thought they could possibly get a fair trial, or that this government in particular, which, you know, this is the government of Aung San Suu Kyi, the democratically elected Nobel Peace Prize winner, who hasn't been able to do anything about the military attacks on the Rohingya? How might she do something about this? I mean, is it thought that she has any power over this oppressive military, which still seems to be running the country?
Well, not a lot, and clearly not enough. The question is whether she's willing to speak out. It's worth remembering, aside from the fact that Aung San Suu Kyi was for many, many years a political prisoner and relied on and was very grateful for enormous amounts of media attention. Many people took a lot of risks to go and see her and expose her plight. Ever since she was released from house arrest and became a significant open political figure, of course, she's got huge amounts of media attention. I've spent some time with her, and when she's had all that attention, there's no doubt she sees herself as an incredibly important person, as the key to Myanmar's destiny. And she has become increasingly impatient with the media because the questions have just got tougher. There's no longer a media that looks up to her as this icon. People are challenging her. She's a very imperious woman. She's very stubborn. People will tell you it's almost impossible to change her mind, and she doesn't like criticism. And so there's no doubt her view of the media has changed. She's become almost completely inaccessible since she came to office. And many people here, many journalists feel, given what's happened to the media and how much harsher the environment has become in the last 2 years, that in some ways she's less sympathetic towards the media than the military government which preceded her, which is an extraordinary irony.
The BBC's Jonathan Head in Bangkok watching events in Myanmar. Jonathan, thank you.
Good to talk to you. Thank you.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.